Let's have another language. Who's got a more exotic good morning? Gang, tell us how to say good morning in Chinese. Sa? Sao?
Sao.
Sao?
Chang.
I fail. Sao Chang? Ho. How? Sao Chang? How? Is that a sort of? Sao Chang Hao. Okay. Right. So last time we talked about gravitational radiation. Let me just summarize. We dealt with this by picking harmonic gauge. Which, as far as the linearized perturbations looks, amounts to this. And you remember h bar mu nu is the trace reversed h equals h mu nu minus 1/2 eta mu nu h lambda lambda. So harmonic gauge just amounts to saying the trace reversed metric perturbation is transverse to the form momentum of the wave. And there were residual gauge transformations, which are harmonic. They obey box equals zero. And so we could still do four more transformations with box epsilon mu equals zero. And so what we did is we picked k mu equals k zero zero k as the form momentum of our gravitational wave. And we saw that this condition eliminates H0i and sets H perp ii equals zero. And by H perp, I mean the components perpendicular to the momentum, i.e. h11 plus h22 equals zero. So that was the first, that was the impact of this gauge choice, was to eliminate four components, i.e. removes four components. And the impact of this one is to epsilon mu nu goes to epsilon mu nu plus c mu k nu plus c nu k mu. We've got four c mu's to so this is epsilon mu equals c mu. Well, I defined the c mu as the Fourier coefficients of the epsilon mu. Maybe I'll just, yeah, let's leave it in the notation I had last time. And we use this one to eliminate H3i and H00. Okay, so we eliminated H33, H00, H31, and H32. And that eliminates another four, so that removes another four components. And so it leaves us with helicity plus or minus two components of a massless spin two field. Okay, so a massless field only has helicity plus two and minus two. If you had a massive field, you would have all five components of spin two. Spin SZ equals two, one, zero, minus one, minus two. But a massless field only has two components. It's interesting to look at what the spin is of these guys. And if you do the calculation, you'll find these have spin at one, not surprisingly, and zero. Spin one because it has a vector index, and anything with a vector index has behaves as a vector under rotations, which has spin one. And the H0, zero, of course, has spin zero. And so these four components get gauged away. So this is why I said last time that if you want to make a theory of only helicity plus or minus two, which are the only components for a massless spin two field, it seems to be essential to have this gauge freedom where you can remove the other three components. That's the way it works. That's the way all relativistic field theories work. As you start off with something that looks like it has, in this case, spin two, and you gauge away the spin one, zero, minus one to leave you with plus or minus two, and therefore only two physical polarization states. Same thing in electromagnetism. You start out with a mu, and so superficially it looks like you have spin one, which should have one, zero, minus one, and you gauge away the spin zero component of that to leave only two physical helicity states. And so this is the basis for Weinberg's statement in his book that if you simply insist on having a massless spin two particle, or for that matter, a massless spin one particle with the physical helicity states, which we observe, you seem to be forced to have some gauge invariance. Okay, and then if you try and interpret what is this gauge invariance, in GR, it's general coordinate invariance. What enabled us to do this transformation here was general coordinate invariance. So in other words, he is saying general coordinate invariance is just a byproduct of the desire to describe a spin two particle, a massless spin two particle. That's it. There's nothing more to it than that. And somehow the internal consistency of the theory forces you to make this general coordinate invariance a full non-perturbative symmetry of the theory. Okay, and you can see that order by order in perturbation theory. So they're the two sort of diametrically opposed points of views, okay? And nobody knows which one is right. One is that the real physical thing is geometrical. Space-time is a geometrical arena. The coordinates don't matter. And physics takes place in this arena. And so obviously, since the whole notion is coordinate invariant, this geometry, you have to insist on coordinate invariance. That's one notion. The other notion is, no, we're actually just doing physics in flat space-time and scattering gravitons and gauge bosons and insisting that theory is consistent. That's it. Okay, and that other theory, which in my view is bizarre, because if you think about cosmology, it's definitely not. We don't live in flat space-time. I mean, what are we doing building our theory on scattering particles in flat space-time? Bizarre. But nevertheless, it's a consistent point of view, and you sort of bootstrap your way up to full general relativity. So, you know, the resolution is probably that both points of view are wrong, okay? And we're still looking for the right basic physical principle. Okay, so let me remind you then. So we last time then calculated the Einstein tensor to linear order. This means linear order in H mu nu. And this turned out to be minus 1/2 box H mu nu. And obviously that was equal to 8 pi g t mu nu. Sorry, there should be a bar on there. So this makes sense because in harmonic gauge, this guy is transverse, right? So d mu of this is zero. Well, but to linear order, the t mu nu doesn't involve h. It's just the stress tensor, stress energy tensor in flat space time. And so this also obeys d mu t mu nu is zero. So at least that's consistent equation, all right? Now both sides obey our divergence. So that's good. And then we solve that equation. This is easy to solve using using the same Green's function you use in electrodynamics. And we solved and showed that H bar mu nu is equal to minus 2g over r d by dt squared of integral rho of x prime k x prime l d3x prime this is t and rho, the density of t and x. Let's write that out. Rho of t and x prime integrated over x prime. And then we take all this and we put t goes to t minus r. Okay, so we just inverted this equation, and I should have the right indices here, KL. Okay, so that's what the inhomogeneous solution of the equation is. It's not unique, because we still have the freedom to perform harmonic coordinate transformations. Okay, just as we had up there, we've got 4 degrees of freedom to use up to further transform this to transverse traceless gauge. To go to TT gauge. Nevertheless, let's write this thing out. And we can write the integral. Integral rho xk x rho of t x prime xk x prime l d3 x prime We write that as the quadrupole moment, QKL, which is a function of t, plus three integral d3 x prime of rho t x prime, where QKL of t is the quadrupole moment, actually, we write it as 1/3 of that, 3x prime k x prime l minus delta k l rho of delta k l x prime squared times rho of t x prime. Okay, so this is the definition of the quadrupole moment, is that we integrate over all space multiplied by this quantity, which is chosen to be traceless. Okay, and then this extra term here is just the trace, and I should have added a delta KL there. Actually, I don't need the 3, do I? In fact, I need a 1/3. Okay, so that was just an identity to rewrite this guy in terms of something maybe more familiar, which is this quadrupole moment, plus a term involving, and I've left out an x prime squared here, a term involving the integral of the density times x squared. And what we're going to do is we will choose a gauge in which the second term disappears. When we go to TT gauge, the second term disappears. And so we're left only with the quadrupole moment. Okay, so you can see that because in transverse traceless gauge, your h bar, remember when you go to transverse traceless gauge, the second step here, you don't change h11. Well, first of all, sit in the z direction along the z axis. You're looking at gravitational waves coming out. So let's draw a picture. Here's this object spinning around. And here's the z-axis. And we're sitting a long way out at positive z. And we're watching the metric as it's coming along here, gravitational waves are coming along here. When we go to transverse traceless gauge, H11, H12, and H22 don't change. Okay, they are exactly what they were. They're not affected by the gauge transformations we use to go to transverse traceless gauge. But all the other components are affected. And so the transverse traceless parts of the right-hand side are unaffected. In other words, the Q components are unaffected by the gauge transformation, and the other terms can be set zero by the gauge transformation. So transverse traceless components of H bar mu nu are unaffected. but the other components can be set 0. And so we end up with the expression that Hij transverse traceless, and this means only, so on the z-axis, the 1-1, well, there in transverse traceless you have this condition. These are the transverse traceless components, and those are just equal to minus 2g over r, 3qij of t, and now I can put, it's qij double dot of t at t goes to t minus r. Okay, so that's all you have left. So the metric perturbation in transverse traceless gauge is just the second derivative of the quadrupole moment up to these factors of G and R. Okay, so now let's work out the energy momentum carried by the gravitational wave. So to understand this, all we need to do is write the Einstein equations out again. And I'm always setting C equals 1 in this section. We'll put C back into the final answers. So this, of course, is minus 1/2 box. H bar mu nu at linear order. But what if I go to higher order? Okay, what if I include second order in H mu nu? That would be the full Einstein equations. And the idea of computing the energy momentum in the gravitational wave is simply to move all these terms over to the left-hand side and call them energy. Okay? So you just take the geometry from the left-hand side of the Einstein equations, leave the linear part on the left-hand side, and move the second-order parts to the right-hand side and call it energy. All right? It's as simple as that. So we get minus 1/2 box H bar mu nu equals 8 pi g t mu nu plus, and then this energy, gravitational energy, let's call it, mu nu. And by the consistency of the equations, you have to have that, again, d mu of, let's call this, I don't know what I should call it. let's call it E mu nu. D mu E mu nu should be zero. So this is called the, sometimes called the pseudo energy tensor, pseudo stress energy tensor. It's kind of an ugly thing. It's a horrible expression in terms of H mu nu. It's not gauge invariant, and but nevertheless, it has the. It depends on which gauge you use, but nevertheless, it has this property that it's conserved. Now, so I won't write out this whole expression. I will just. So E mu nu is given. Is given. And Weinberg equations 7.6.15 and 10.3.1. It's basically related to the second order terms in the Ricci tensor. It can be written in terms of the second order terms in the Ricci tensor, but change the sign relative to me, because Weinberg defines the Ricci curvature. Weinberg defines the Riemann curvature such that the Ricci scalar for a sphere is negative, which is a strange choice. The curvature of a sphere is negative, but never mind. He always has a minus sign relative to me. And then what you find, oh, so it's just a very ugly expression, okay? Now, if you say, I don't mind doing some averaging of this quantity, if we average E mu nu over oscillatory terms, of over oscillations. You see you have this wave traveling along, and the wave is oscillating. And if you multiply two pieces of two H mu nu's together, and they're both oscillating and they're not in phase, you're going to get some oscillatory term, which actually you don't care about, because it means the energy flux is going positive and positive and negative from that term, and it will just cancel. So if you average this over oscillations, i.e. in space and time, i.e. You can do this kind of thing. If you have A d mu B, you can replace this with minus d mu A B. So you just drop total derivatives. Drop total derivatives. It's like integrating by parts. Okay. Then this awful expression E mu nu simplifies enormously. Then E mu nu goes over to minus 1/4, and this averaging over oscillations, then it is d mu h rho sigma d nu h rho sigma minus 1/2 d mu h d nu h minus d rho h rho sigma d mu h nu sigma plus d nu h mu sigma. And that's it. And where the integrand, and in TT gauge, the right hand side is equal to 1 over. Is equal to 1/4. Just make sure I get the sign right. -1/4. D mu h rho sigma tt d mu h rho sigma tt. Okay, so when you go to transverse traceless gauge, these terms disappear, these two terms disappear. You can kind of see this. This involves the transverse piece of H. This involves the trace. Turns out all of these combine into this in transverse traceless gauge. And so there's just a single term. And so we can say that the stress energy tensor in gravitational waves is equal to, so I just take this this term and divide by 8 pi g, and so I get -1/32 πg. Let's put quotes around it of h of d mu h rho sigma tt d nu h rho sigma tt. Okay, so that's the energy in gravitational waves. As I said, the reason why it's useful at all is because of this equation. You see, it is divergenceless, meaning that you can interpret the 0, 0 component of this guy as an energy. Okay, and the 0 mu, the 0 i components, is an energy flux. And so in the full equation, you do have a concept of energy conservation, even though in general relativity, in general, there's no real concept of energy conservation, because you only have this, right? You only have covariant energy conservation. That's not good enough to make a conservation law. It was only when we had this equation, then you could write integral d3x t naught naught is constant. Okay, you need something with an ordinary derivative in order to define an energy which is conserved. But by doing this, that's exactly what we've got. And so you really can say this is the energy in gravitational waves. And the total energy in the system would be the sum of these two terms. And it should be conserved. So in other words, when the source emits gravitational waves, the source has to lose energy. OK, so now let's calculate that and calculate how much energy is lost into gravitational waves. This E mu nu, by the way, is sometimes called the Landau-Lifschitz pseudo energy tensor. Pseudo energy momentum tensor. And you'll find it in Landau and Lifschitz's book on field theory, on electrodynamics, actually. Thank you. So again, we've got our object. It's emitting along the z axis. And so let's just sit here and measure the energy flux. Okay, so what is the energy flux? Well, that would be T gravitational wave 03. Okay, that is the flux. Remember, d0 t00 is equal to minus di ti0. So this flux, if I integrate across a surface, this is telling me how much energy is leaving the surface. T gravitational wave 03 is minus T gravitational wave 03, if I lower the indices, because the 0 picks up a minus sign. And so that's equal to 1 over 32 pi g, right, times the average of d0 h. And in transverse traceless, all I've got are the perpendicular indices, 1 and 2, and then d3 h I j. Just see. Sorry, somehow I've got a minus sign wrong. I think that was, oh, that's because of E mu nu, so I moved it to this plus. Right? The E mu nu. Where did I have my E mu nu? Oh, I moved it there. I'm sorry. So actually, that should be a plus because I'd already moved it to the other side. And this should be plus. And then I divided by 8 pi g. Okay, so all of those are plus signs. And so here I should have a minus. Okay, so now we've got that hij, transverse traceless, is a function of z, hij, transverse traceless, is a function of z minus t. Okay, because it's moving in the z direction with the speed of light. And so what that means is that d0, hij, is equal to minus d3 hij, just differentiating this, which is hij transverse traceless prime as a function of its argument. And so on the right-hand side, I have 1 over 32 pi g, and then I have this averaging of H transverse traceless prime 1 squared plus H transverse traceless prime 2 squared plus twice H 1 transverse traceless prime squared. Okay, just summing over these indices, which are perpendicular to the 3 direction. Now then, we just rewrite this in TT gauge. H1, H22 is equal to minus H11 TT. So we can combine these two terms as follows. Pull a factor of 2 out and write this as 1 quarter h11 prime minus h22 prime squared plus h12 prime squared. with TTs on everything. Okay, why is this true? Well, if H22 is minus H11, then this is a factor of 2 times H11. I square it, divide by 4, I get 1, a factor of 1 times H11 prime squared. Now, these two terms are equal, and I've divided by 2 here. So the right and the left and the right hand sides are equal. And why did I write it like that? Well, because I know exactly what these things are in TT gauge from a formula I have erased. So before we had H11 in terms of, remember, we had HTTIJ was something like the quadrupole QIJ double dot G over R. Okay, so this turns out, so I just plug this into there. This is QIJ. It's a function of T minus R, of course. R is just Z, because I'm sitting on the Z axis at some large Z. I'm supposed to differentiate and square. So I've got to take another derivative of the quadrupole moment. And what I get is G, this should be the flux in the positive Z direction, G over 36 pi R squared, Q12 triple dot squared plus 1/4 Q11 triple dot minus Q22 triple dot squared. And the reason I got this 1 over 36 is that the H had a 2/3 here. 2/3. Squaring that gives me a 4/9. I get G squared over R squared from the H. And then I have a 1 over 16 pi G. And hopefully that agrees. Okay, so we're almost there. We've worked out the flux of gravitational energy, gravitational energy across a surface perpendicular to the z-axis at large z. What I want to know is the expression at any angle. I've worked it out at one angle, and I'd like to know what the flux is at any angle from the source. But that we can get just by rotational invariance. From this, we can infer the flux of energy at any, or in any direction, just by rotational invariance. Okay, so if the source here was a scalar thing, if there were no indices here, the source was a scalar, and I worked out the flux on the z-axis, I could say trivially the flux is going to be the same in every direction, and integrate over all directions. But this has some indices. Okay, so when I rotate, I better be careful and keep track of those indices. So we'll work it out using a kind of clever trick, which is the following, that in direction ni, t0i, ni, so this is, let's write it as t gravitational wave, 0i ni. This is the flux in direction ni. And what can it possibly be equal to? Well, it must, let's just write it as this factor. And then it's got to be a scalar. It's got to be, this is, the left-hand side is a scalar under rotations because the I indices are contracted. So the right-hand side must be a scalar. KL plus B. So you just write down the most general scalar quantity under rotations. KL Q KM NL NM. Okay, so how to make a scalar out of an object with two tensor indices? Well, I either just contract those indices, or I contract the n's with those indices. And I've got to use two indices up, and so I have to use two n's. Remember, this q is traceless, so there's no point in summing these indices over each other because it's traceless. So this is the only thing you can write down. C, Q, K, L, dot, 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 N, K, N, L. So this is the most general rotational invariant made from Q, K, L, and NK. Okay, the right-hand side is the most general thing you can write down, which is rotationally invariant, and of course, second order and second order in Q double dot, triple dot. That last term should be squared. Okay, where A, B, and C are constants. And so now we'll just work it out. So this is equal to A. If Ni equals 0, 0, 1, this must equal what we got already, Q12 triple dot squared plus 1 quarter Q1 triple dot, sorry, Q11 triple dot minus Q22 triple dot squared, which is what we had before. And so what I can write down is this expression with n equal to this vector in the three direction. So it's A, Q11, I'm not going to bother putting the triple dots on, plus Q22 squared plus Q33 squared. That's just the first term with cross terms Q12 squared plus Q23 squared plus Q13 squared. And then I've got plus B Q13 squared plus Q23 squared plus Q33 squared. And then I've got plus C Q33 squared. Okay, so now I can use the tracelessness of Q Q33 equals minus Q1 minus Q22. And equate coefficients of Q11, Q22, and Q12. Okay, so on the left-hand side, I've got something only involving 11, 12, and 22. On the right-hand side, after using this formula, I have the same thing. The left and right-hand side have to be equal for any q, for any quick q, and so I can just read off the coefficients. So the coefficients of Q11 squared gives me 2a plus b plus c equals 1/4. So I'm just, you see this Q33 squared is going to give me a Q11 squared, so I have 2a. And then this Q33 squared is going to give me another Q11 squared, so plus b plus c. And on the left-hand side, I've got 1/4 as the coefficient of Q11 squared. I've dropped the triple dots. And then coefficient of Q11, Q22, I get Q2a plus 2b plus 2c equals minus one half. Coefficient of Q12 squared, I get 2a equals 1. And this is already three equations for three unknowns, so I can solve uniquely. But then actually I have a couple of other equations to check. Q13 squared, and this gives me 2a plus b equals 0. So I can use this as a check that all of this is consistent. And let's see. So I've got four equations for three unknowns. And the solution is very easy. From here, a is 1/2. From there, b is minus 1. And so from either of these equations, c is 1/4. And then you can check the other equation, and it's true. And so what we conclude is that T0iNi in gravitational waves, the flux of energy out of the system in any direction is g over 36 pi r squared times 1/2 qkl qkl minus qk l qkm N L N M plus 1/4 Q K L N K N L squared with triple dots on everything. And we're still not quite done, because now we have the flux of energy in any direction. We should integrate over all directions if we want to find the total energy lost to gravitational waves. so the energy dt, this is the energy emitted as gravitational waves usually called the power that says I should take the flux in any direction and integrate over all directions. And so now you just have to do some angular integrals. We have to, so integral d omega is of course 4 pi. Integral d omega n l n m, these are the direction vectors the direction vectors pointing along the gravitational wave. But if I integrate this over all directions, the first thing you can see is it must be proportional delta Lm by symmetry. There's nothing else it can be. It's got to, the answer, I've integrated over all directions, so the answer must be rotational invariant. So it must be delta Lm. And if I take the trace of the equation, the trace of this is 1. The trace of this is 3. OK, so I must have a factor of 3 and 4 pi. OK, so it's rather easy to do these integrals. You could substitute in, you know, cosines and sines and do all the integrals. Or you could just use the fact that it must be proportional to delta by symmetry, and then take the trace and read off the coefficient. And likewise, this integral, n l n n k n l n m n n, this is equal to 4 pi over 15, and then again by symmetry k l delta m n plus delta k m delta L n plus delta k n delta L m. Obviously, the left-hand side is symmetric under any exchange of indices, so the right-hand side must be as well. The only thing it can be is this symmetric product of deltas. Take the trace on two indices, and I'll get 1 and 1 here. So the take the trace on any two indices here, and you'll get 15, and so you can read off the answer. And so this means that I can take this expression and average over or integrate over angle to remove those terms, and all I get is that the power, the rate of loss of energy, is g over 45. Now let me see. I needed an r squared here. Okay, because the rate of loss of energy would be the area element minus times the energy flux. Okay, this is the area element. So there's an r squared there that cancels the 1 over r squared on the right-hand side. So I get g over 45 times qkl triple dot. QKL triple dot, and that's it. And so that is called the Landau-Lifshitz formula and it gives you the rate at which gravitational waves take energy out of any system. Okay, so it's a very beautiful formula. You can see that the derivation is a little bit iffy, okay? Because we had to define this gravitational energy tensor, which wasn't gauge invariant. We had to assume the linearized approximation, which is always a little bit iffy. What happened to the H terms in the source? You're neglecting them. And indeed, that iffiness has made people nervous for quite a long time. And the iffiness turned out to be justified because this really doesn't fully capture what's going on. Okay, it's pretty good, but there's some other effects like this memory effect in the gravitational radiation, which of course is what all the fuss is about now regarding the black hole information paradox. Okay, nevertheless, this is a nice formula and hard to improve on. And it won two people the Nobel Prize. Okay, because what Hulse and Taylor did, they discovered the binary pulsar. Okay, so this is two neutron stars in tight orbit around each other, 1913 plus 16A. And this binary pulsar, so these two compact objects orbiting each other very fast, one of them happens to be emitting radio waves along a beam. And so as it spins, we see this beam flashing at us like a lighthouse, bang, 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 bang. So there's some particular point on its surface which has a huge magnetic field. Basically, we believe these neutron stars are superconducting. And so they confine magnetic fields. And all kinds of amazing phenomena are happening at their surface. But basically, there's a particular area of very intense electromagnetic activity. And every time this beam points at us, we see a flash of radio waves. So this thing is just like a beacon sending us a signal very frequently, many times a second. And from that signal, we can figure out all the parameters of the system. We can figure out we can see the Doppler shift as it comes towards us, goes away from us, and so on. And from all of that, you can figure out all the parameters of the system, both masses, the radius, and so on. And then you can predict. So we fit all the parameters, meaning the separation, masses, angular momenta, etc. And from all those parameters, you can just predict this formula. So predict P. And then what they did is measure the orbital period. And how the orbital period changes with time. Okay, and obviously what you predict is that as the thing loses energy, the orbital period should decrease. Right, it's losing energy, so the two objects are falling in towards each other. They should go around each other faster and faster. Just Newtonian mechanics. Okay, and then they made a beautiful graph, which you'll find on the web. And the graph is the received time of the signal versus, the received separation in, the inferred period, inferred time delay. So basically, you see these pulses. You infer where. So, how can I describe it? There is a technical word for it. But basically, you measure these flashes of light, and you infer the orbital period, and integrate all that up. The period changes linearly with time. But when you integrate it up, you get a quadratic in time. Okay, so the total time delay goes like this, where this curve is a parabola. Okay, and this is how they chose to plot it, because it kind of looks nicer. And all the data is just... Okay, so this is the integrated time delay. And the x's are the predictions of this equation. Okay, so it's an absolutely clean prediction once you've fitted all the parameters. Saying it fits so beautifully is a little bit misleading because it's just a parabola. If you took the derivative, it would be a straight line. It would look less impressive. But that's how they plotted it, and that won them the Nobel Prize. And these days, the situation is even more impressive because they've discovered new pulsars which involve more than one object. In particular, I've forgotten its symbol, but you'll also find it on the web. There's a new pulsar with two very close objects, so close that the linearized approximation fails near the objects. As we said, that's not very surprising. Neutron stars have H of order 1, okay, at their surface. So these are two really very close objects. They have large gravitational fields. And then there's another third object orbiting around them. And this combination is like a beautiful laboratory for gravitational waves and other effects. And these are under very close observation. And they are now providing tests of strong gravity, I mean, beyond linear theory. So those have to be compared with full-blown solutions of the full Einstein equations found, for example, numerically on computers. Yeah?
Can gravitational waves carry any angular momentum?
Yes, they can. So, I mean, it's just like if I... how should I say it? Yeah, they carry both energy and angular momentum. It depends on the symmetries of the source. And so, in general, they will carry away gravitational. In fact, they can radiate energy, they can radiate angular momentum, they can even radiate momentum. Okay? Which actually causes something called the gravitational rocket effect. If you have a source that radiates momentum in some direction, well, the source has got to accelerate because it's emitting momentum one way. Okay, it's literally a rocket. And so certain types of objects, if they have the right lack of symmetry, will actually emit momentum and zoom off in the other direction. So you could make a rocket ship that was powered by gravitational wave emission. Okay. Now, as I said, it's a little bit iffy, and it's actually unknown, still unknown, what the corrections are to this formula. Okay, we except by doing big numerical simulations, you don't really know how to correct this for nonlinear effects. Though there's been a lot of work, and I must admit, I've not followed it in detail. So people have certainly worked very hard in the last 10 years to try to improve this and make effective theories and so on, which capture things better than Landau and Lifshitz did. Let's take some examples. You see, normally, let's just do some order of magnitude estimates. Oh, actually, before I do that, let me restore the speed of light, which I said equal to 1. It's not difficult by dimensions to see it has to be c to the fifth. We'll see that in a second. So I just put this back by dimensions. And so the power, let's imagine, for example, I've got some object like a metal bar, which I spin, and I want to know how much gravitational waves will it, how much energy will it emit per unit second in gravitational waves. And let's imagine it spinning with angular frequency omega. Well, then obviously the quadrupole moment goes like the mass times a length squared. When I defined the quadrupole moment, I should have said rho mass, x, k, x, l. This is rho mass. Okay, so the definition of the quadrupole moment is that I take the mass density and integrate over space times various things, whatever it was, delta k, l, x squared. Quadrupole moment by dimensions is a mass times a distance squared. The power goes like omega to the sixth times Newton's constant times m squared L to the fourth over c to the fifth. And that's not hard to see that that has the right dimensions. Remember, the gravitational energy of an object is gm squared over L. That's the gravitational potential energy. Okay, so the left-hand side is an energy divided by a time. The right-hand side, that combination makes an energy, gm squared over L. So we've got omega to the sixth over c to the fifth, L to the fifth, gm squared over L. This is an energy. And this here is obviously L over C is a time. So we've got a time to the fifth divided by a frequency to the sixth. So we've got a frequency. And this, of course, the power is the rate of loss of energy. So you can see the units make sense. For a 1 meter bar, which weighs for L equals 1 meter, M equals 1 kilogram, omega equals 1 per second. Just put everything equal to 1. This is tiny because C is 3 × 10⁸. Okay? And it's going like 1 over C to the fifth. And if G is not too big either, G is 6.7 × 10⁻¹ⁱ in SI units. And so the power goes like 10⁻¹² watts. Okay, that's the rate of loss of energy. So it's not very big okay, for ordinary objects. Now, it's easy to see how to make it bigger. We've got to go to much more massive objects. It goes like m squared. Much bigger objects. It's always true with gravity. Gravity is very non-local, okay? You can kind of see that from the basic formulation and the equivalence principle. The whole point of the equivalence principle was that locally, physics should look like physics without gravity. Gravity only comes in when you go to larger distances. That's the whole point of the theory. So pretty much always, gravitational energies increase with scale. And this one certainly does. And so if we go to Jupiter in orbit, you can work out how much energy is Jupiter losing to gravitational waves. Well, this is only 5 kilowatts. Okay, so Jupiter's a few light bulbs. Loses the equivalent of a few light bulbs to gravitational waves due to its orbit around the sun. But a pulsar a spinning pulsar well, let's say a pulsar binary, just to get a biggest effect. So we have these masses and their distance L. This can be greater than 10 to the 48 watts. So that's getting up there, and that becomes measurable. So whenever you're testing GR, you want to look at the biggest, obviously fastest moving objects you can find. So you want to maximize M, L, omega. Of course, typically if you increase L, omega will go down. You make something very big, it's not going to be orbiting very fast, so there's some balance between M and omega. But these pulsars are sitting just at the right place to really test general relativity. Okay, so I guess I will stop for questions. Are there any questions? You didn't ring your alarm at me. Is that because it's Monday? Okay. I see. Okay. All right. Well, I hope you all had enough sleep on the weekend so you're not too exhausted now. So ask any questions. I was going to tell you about the Schwarzschild metric, but let's do that tomorrow. So that's the other, you see, this is the hard part of GR, is calculating the waves and the radiation. Tricky part. The equivalent of the Coulomb potential in electrodynamics, if you ask what's the electric field of a point charge, it's 1 over r squared, right? That's the most trivial thing you can do in electromagnetism. And it's sort of forced on you by dimensions and symmetry. It just has to be 1 over r squared. Nothing else it can be. But in GR, the equivalent to that problem is to ask what's the gravitational field or metric of a spherically symmetric object. And it's kind of 1 over r. We've seen that already, that the H00 was 1 over r. But they're corrections, 1 over r squared, 1 over r cubed, 1 over corrections. And that's what we'll do with the Schwarzschild metric. And then basically all tests of GR so far really come down to either testing the gravitational waves or to testing the Schwarzschild metric. It's not very much else yet. That should change in the next 5 years, because we're beginning to see the effects of angular momentum. Black hole doesn't have to be spherically symmetric. It can be spinning. They are generally spinning. Some of them are spinning quite fast. And then their metric deviates from Schwarzschild, and that becomes very interesting. Then you can do tests of non-spherically symmetric metrics. But tomorrow we'll do the Schwarzschild metric and then study black holes. And we will fall into a black hole, imaginary black hole, and hopefully discuss a little bit about this information puzzle. And then probably in the last lecture I'll do a little bit of cosmology, which is much more interesting than anything I've told you yet. Okay, so any questions about this? Yes.
So when we think about the propagation of gravitational waves, we did this around flat background because
yes,
that's the easiest scenario where we can do this. But if we look at these gravitational wave signatures from these pulsars, they come from really far away, and they're propagating on a space-time that we believe has non-dimensional cosmological constant.
That's true.
So how would that affect the results? Because you know the,
yes,
the fit with that pulse Taylor.
Almost not at all.
Yeah.
Yeah, not at all. It would be tiny. The reason is that the cosmological constant, if you think about it as a length scale, let's see how to say it. Yeah, so lambda defines a length scale. And if you are smaller than that length scale, the effect of lambda is negligible. Roughly speaking, lambda is like a mass in the graviton equation, okay? Because you have, instead of box H mu nu, you would have lambda H mu nu. And so lambda defines a length scale. This length scale, which So this happens to be the Hubble radius. Okay, which is 3,000 H inverse megaparsecs. So there's this length scale beyond which lambda really matters, but it's 3,000 megaparsec. Now, these pulsars that we observe are in our own galaxy, and our own galaxy is only 100 kiloparsecs. Okay, so our own galaxy is less than 100 kiloparsecs. And so let's see, we're down by a factor of 1 over 30,000 in length. So unfortunately, these effects are very small. And I think they go like the square of that. And so you just can't see it. Too small to see. But if we start measuring gravitational waves from pulsars which are very far away, then it matters. And in fact, this is there's a beautiful set of papers by somebody, what is his name? Dan Holtz. Okay, so what Holtz showed, and he has a collaborator whose name I've forgotten, but if you look up Dan Holtz, he's a very young guy at Chicago. And what he did is he considered the scenario where we're able to detect gravitational wave sources all the way out to the Hubble radius. Okay, so the universe is full of these things. It turns out once you begin to detect gravitational wave sources, then actually going further and further is not that difficult. Roughly speaking, because the universe was a lot smaller at early times, okay, when the thing was emitted, when the wave was emitted, and the universe subsequently has expanded. But that's a very rough argument. But basically, you can see quite distant sources rather easily, turns out, if you have enough sensitivity. So the futuristic gravitational wave experiments like LISA, which is a triangle, a big triangle you put in space, and you measure the lengths of the arms of this triangle to detect gravitational waves, they will see sources right out to the Hubble radius. Another way you can do it is to use neutron stars, because our galaxy is full of neutron stars. They're all beaming at us. They provide an array which will detect gravitational waves. So just use nature to construct this gigantic gravitational wave detector. And that's going to happen when the Square Kilometer Array comes online, which is about 2020. So we should see this. It's in South Africa, so I'm particularly thrilled about it. But when we start measuring thousands of millisecond pulsars, which is what the Square Kilometer Array will do, we'll have this gigantic gravitational wave antenna that will see sources all the way out to the Hubble radius. When you do that, what Holtz realized is they make the cosmic microwave background look pathetic. Okay, the cosmic microwave background we've used to measure the expansion rate of the universe, the density, the lambda, all the other parameters to within a percent or so. The gravitational waves, you're going to get down to 10 to the minus 6, 10 to the minus 7 in these cosmological parameters, and you'll be able to, you know, blow everything out of the water. You'll measure properties of the dark matter. You'll measure all sorts of details of the universe. And it's interesting because before his work, people designing gravitational wave detectors like LIGO or LISA really focused on the gravitational waves. They didn't focus on the spin-off. But it turns out the spin-off is probably much more significant even than detecting the gravitational waves, because we're pretty sure these waves will exist. We've seen them in the binary pulsar. We're pretty sure GR is right. I mean, it's worth testing. But nobody really has a rival theory that is anything like as compelling. But if it is correct, we're going to be able to use it to map the properties of the universe and all the unknown stuff, like the dark energy and the dark matter, to huge precision. So that's a very, very exciting prospect. So it's exactly what you're suggesting. Yep.
gravitational waves redshift the way, the same way as electromagnetic
radiation? Yes, they do. So gravitational waves, I mean, the rough argument for why things redshift is the following. Imagine I take a universe which is a torus, or a sphere in space, okay, and it expands. So there's a certain number, put a wave on that sphere or in the torus. Let's say a torus, periodic boundary conditions, and I put a wave, and now it expands. Well, the number of zeros in the wave can't change, okay? And so as the thing stretches, the wavelength has got to stretch. So any form of radiation, any form of wave in the universe, as the universe expands, the wave has to grow. Okay, it's really forced on you. And so in particular, the wavelength of gravitational waves has to increase, the wavelength of electromagnetic waves has to increase. And when they do that, their energy decreases inversely with the wavelength. So just saying it is massless immediately gives you that the energy goes like the frequency. That's the quantum condition, E is h nu. And nu goes 1 over the lambda. Lambda has to go with the size of the universe. So any massless radiation has to have an energy that decreases, that redshifts away. Photons, gravitational waves, even if you have some scalar field with wave, massless fields, they all have to redshift away.
Yep. Are there analogies between gravitational waves and EM waves for like indices of refraction or like a metal which fields can't
penetrate?
Yeah,
that's a good question.
Things like that.
I'm sure there are. I think when the gravitational wave passes through matter, it must have a similar effect. So if a gravitational wave passes through the Earth, it's obviously going to be distorting the material it's passing through, and that will change the dispersion relation. That will change the relationship between frequency and wave number, and that will mean it propagates at a different speed. At least the group velocity is different. The phase velocity is always the speed of light. But
can you have something which oscillates so quickly in response that shields, like a metal or something?
Oh, okay, I see. I don't think so. I mean, there is a... It's a good question. I don't know the answer. The difference, there is a big difference, which is that electromagnetic fields can be screened. Okay, so if we bounce radio waves off the ionosphere, the reason they bounce off is because they're screened. That, you know, you have this electric field propagating upwards, and then it causes the charged particles up there to jangle in such a way that they cancel the original field, and so it doesn't propagate any further, it just bounces off. With gravitational waves, everything couples to gravitational waves with the same sign. There's no positive and negative charges. And so it's sort of fundamentally different. Everything has the same attractive gravitational field. And so I don't know. I haven't seen anybody talk about that. But I suspect it's not going to be possible to make them bounce. I suspect they will just propagate.
But even though the force is always attractive, can you have opposite polarizations that will cancel or interfere that way?
Maybe. I don't know. I've never seen anyone talk about that. Worth thinking about. You'd need some pretty dense matter. Because I think, if we just work out the strength, you know, the typical value, so H is a dimensionless number. The typical value for astrophysical sources of H, if you measure the value at the Earth, it's something like 10 to the minus 22. Okay, so this pulsar emits gravitational waves, and then the wave comes through the Earth. This is called a dimensionless strain. And it basically tells you the length change. It's almost nothing. So these waves just go right through the Earth. They hardly even notice it. They're so weak that all they do is jiggle the positions of the atoms by 10 to the minus 22, that doesn't take much, doesn't transfer much energy to those atoms, because they're, you know, they're all repelling each other, they're in their crystalline positions or whatever, so, but you're hardly changing their distance. The displacements are minuscule. And so these gravitational waves just go straight through the Earth or other mediums. So I think the only way you'd get a big effect is by having pretty dense matter, like in a neutron star, and much stronger gravitational fields. So it's possible in this new pulsar, for example, that that might be an interesting effect. You could imagine that as the pulsar itself, you know, this body comes around, its internal structure is actually interfering with the emission of gravitational waves. It's conceivable. Any other questions? Yeah.
How do you average over oscillations in space and time?
So I went through that rather quickly, just because it's messy. So in time, it's quite easy to see. So imagine I've got h going like, you know, sine kt. And then, imagine my metric perturbation goes like sine kt. And then I calculate the t mu nu in gravitational waves. Well, this is going to include terms which go like h squared, which are sine squared kt. And when I average over time, this just gives a half. Okay, so that gives a non-zero result when I average it. But I might also get h d naught h, let's say. And this one will, let's say it goes like cos k x d1 h d naught h. Okay, so this one will go like, sine kt cos kt, and then cos kx sine kx. And so when I average in time, this averages to zero. This is telling me that there's no net transfer of energy due to this term. Averaging over space is a bit more delicate, how to justify it. But this is still what people do. you basically say, I guess so. You see, when I drew this surface, you see, I could imagine there's you see, if there are terms like this, which depend on where I put the surface, and if they're positive if I put the surface here, but negative if I put it there, they're probably not really carrying energy. Okay, the terms which go like cos squared kx, when I average over space, this again gives a half. And so that term I sort of has to be there. So it's a bit of a delicate argument. And there's a maybe the short answer is you could just go ahead and keep all those terms and do the integrals, and you'll find they don't give anything. Any other questions? Yes?
So suppose that we are living in an anti-de-Sitter state. Mm. So in that case, like, we will have a negative energy term.
Yes.
So in that case, is it possible to have those screening apples?
No. Doesn't really change the nature of gravity. Anti-de-Sitter space is a very strange space. In our universe, lambda is positive. In anti-de-Sitter, it's negative. Anti-de-Sitter space is very interesting for mathematical reasons, because what's the best way of saying it? Okay. anti-de Sitter space is a de Sitter space, the one we live in. If you look globally, it's a non-singular space without any spatial boundary. So the one we live in, it's a very profound fact. The de Sitter space, the one we seem to be living in, or at least going into, has no space like, has no boundary. Okay, topologically, it's a sphere. On space-like slices. Anti-de Sitter space has boundaries, okay, at infinity. And you impose very special boundary conditions on that boundary. When you impose those boundary conditions, it's like putting gravity in a box, and it's actually like killing the most interesting gravitational mode. The boundary condition excludes the mode which causes the expansion of the universe. So you cannot study cosmology in anti-de Sitter space. I mean, it really is a very harsh boundary condition in which you throw out the most interesting mode, which is the expansion of the universe. So mathematically, it's convenient to get rid of that mode, and then you get ADS CFT, and you get all sorts of interesting mathematical results. But it is not at all realistic. You cannot describe the expansion of the universe within anti-de Sitter space with the usual boundary conditions. So I would say anti-de Sitter space is useful as a mathematical device to eliminate the troublesome aspects of GR. But the problem is that the troublesome aspects are exactly the interesting aspects. Okay. So when you go to anti-de Sitter space, you're throwing out everything interesting to a first approximation in terms of cosmology, forcing these boundary conditions, which eliminate gravitational instability. So it's interesting, but it's not, it's just ignoring the interesting questions.
So in this kind of space, do we have that pre-gravitational wave or the gravitational
Yes.
Wave?
No, in anti-de Sitter space, you have gravitational waves. So in anti-de Sitter space, you have boundaries, where, as I said, you force very strong boundary conditions here. But you can still emit gravitational waves, and they can interact with things, and then they can come out again. The funny thing that happens in anti-de Sitter space is that null rays propagate all the way from infinity to the center and back out again in a finite time. Okay, so the time is finite. So it really is like a box. You send stuff into the box, it comes back in a finite time. You can then decide to reflect it and send it back in. And so in anti-de Sitter space, you get sort of dynamics like this that, or maybe I should draw it this way. Something just rattles back and forth in the box, time after time after time. And so people like Luis Lena study these solutions. So typically what happens is if I have anti-de Sitter space and I send in a gravitational wave, it goes right through and bounces. Now there's some nonlinear effects going on in the bulk, creating little disturbances. And my wave keeps coming back. Each time it comes back, it amplifies those disturbances. And so in a finite total time, you make a singularity. Okay. So anti-de Sitter space is, yeah, like this box in which you see gravitational instability. And so at some point, people were very excited that by this instability because they thought it might be thermalization. Because the belief is that the boundary theory is a field theory which should thermalize. And the thermal state should be a black hole. So if these gravitational waves indeed made a black hole in the bulk, that would be correspond to thermalization on the boundary. I think the scenario never really worked out, but there was some interest that from the gravitational point of view, the formation of a black hole would be like thermalization in the boundary theory. I haven't worked on this myself, but my understanding is this hasn't quite panned out. And there's still a lot that is not understood. about gravitational wave dynamics in anti-de Sitter space, what it really means. But it's like a box, a box in which you exclude much of the interesting gravitational physics. It's too bad because anti-de Sitter space, a lot is known, but it's not really relevant to most interesting questions. Okay, I better stop. See you tomorrow.